Great pleasure to see you again, Anne. Dame Anne Salmon, one of the most distinguished historical anthropologists in the world, and to have a chance to talk to you about your life and work. I hadn't realised that it was going to coincide with your seminar this evening, so I don't want to put you to too much bother now, but this is just an informal occasion just to talk about your life and work. So, you were born in 1945. Can you tell me something about your parents and your background?
Well, I was brought up in a town called Gisborne on the east coast of New Zealand, and it's a sort of 50-50 Māori Pākehā community. And my dad had a textile factory with his two brothers, and we were a large family of eight kids, and so there was a very big sprawling clan of children. And so I grew up in the middle of all of that, and had an idyllic childhood in Gisborne, going to the beach and learning to swim and playing tennis and reading voraciously.
Tell me something about the character of your parents. Your mother particularly influenced you a lot.
My mother is, she's a very generous person, and I spent her whole life really looking after other people. She's sharply intelligent, and she reads enormously. She's 86 now. She still belongs to a reading club and goes and reports on books that she's been reading. But I think that the main thing in her life is her very large family. And so she spends her entire life keeping all the networks active, making sure that everybody is in touch with everybody else. She's just a wonderful person in that way.
You have brothers and sisters?
Yes, there's eight of us. And so I'm one of eight.
Which one are you?
I'm the oldest girl.
I see. And you stayed in one place all through your childhood, did you?
Well, I was brought up in Gisborne, and then I was sent away to boarding school when I was 13. So I went away to a girls' boarding school in Masterton. And I found that quite hard, because I'd been used to being part of this gang of brothers and sisters, and we were very close. And so going away to boarding school was tough.
Mm. Were there any teachers there who particularly influenced you? This often is the case with academics, one or two who inspire you or depress you or something.
Well, I think I had some really excellent. There was an English teacher called Mr. Bird who I remember and have kept in touch with, and he was a lovely fellow. And I loved doing English. I loved reading. I loved writing. But I would say that the thing that happened to me was at the end of my sixth form year, which was the year before you leave school. I was lucky. I won a American Field Service scholarship to go to the States, and so I was sprung out of this school of 160 girls. And went to a very large, largely Jewish school, secondary school in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. And that whole experience was just mind-blowing for me. It was just extraordinary. I was meeting up with people from all over the world, because we met as field scholars, and we were from everywhere. And at the end of the year, we went around the whole of the States in a bus with, you know, kids from 36 countries in one bus. And we went to the White House, and Jack Kennedy spoke to us, which was very inspiring. And I learned about anthropology my senior year at college in the States. So for me, that was, I think, a revelation. And I loved meeting people from other countries and hearing and getting to know something about the complexity of life in the world, and decided that when I came home, I wanted to follow that through. But I also learned in that year my ignorance of things Māori.
Things Māori?
Yeah, well, I was brought up, as I say, in a town that was 50-50 Māori and European.
When you say Māori, my hearing is very bad.
It's Māori. But Māori is the correct pronunciation. Yeah. When I was a field scholar, I had to go and talk to all sorts of community groups and Rotary and all these groups and tell them about my country. And when I came to talking about anything to do with the Māori side of New Zealand, I ended up making it up because I didn't know much. I'd learnt a few action songs before I went, and in the process met a couple of women who were very influential later on, two Māori women who were very impressive, fine women. And so
Were they the ones you worked with later?
Well, they sort of. Because I realised during that year I knew nothing about that side of my own, you know, my own hometown, my own country, even though I was surrounded by Māori people, and it was very much part of my family history as well. I've got a great-grandfather who was a filmmaker, who was a fluent Māori speaker, who was a carver, ended up being the acting director of the Dominion Museum, and he made some of the first ethnographic films in the world. But for all that, you know, I just didn't know much about these people. So when I came back to New Zealand, I came back in the middle of our academic year, because we run our years sort of February to December, and I had 6 months back home in Gisborne, so I started to learn the language, Māori language, and I worked in the local museum for 6 months in the Māori collection, cataloguing it. And I started to meet lots of Māori people, and I was introduced to, I learnt lots more songs because I love singing, and I fell in love with it. I just thought these were amazing people. I was just fascinated by the things I started to learn, and I hadn't realised there was another whole landscape that was a Māori landscape, the same place I'd been brought up in, but different stories, different people, different language, different names. Yeah, I was exactly like that, and one that I felt very much at home in. I just felt comfortable.
The college was, all these terms are different. Was that a university?
No. I'm talking about a secondary school.
I see.
Yeah, high school.
High school.
Yeah.
So you came back, having finished your high school days, really, and you applied to do what at university? Presumably went on.
Well, I applied to do anthropology because, but it was really because that's where I could learn Māori. And by then I was just hooked and fixated. And I just wanted to learn as much as I could learn. And so I joined, as soon as I got to the University of Auckland, I joined the Māori Club. And so I was one of the few Pākehā kids in the Māori Club. And that's where I learned to do action songs more, you know, with the kids my own generation. And I studied anthropology with Ralph Piddington, Ralph Woolmer, people like that, and found that riveting. I really enjoyed it. But primarily I went to anthropology because that's where I could study Māori.
Who were your most inspired teachers at the university, would you say? Were there those two famous anthropologists you mentioned?
I think Ralph Piddington was a very interesting lecturer. He was somebody that was, he distilled it all into an introductory textbook into social anthropology. And he used to give a standard set of lectures. They didn't change much from year to year, and every now and then he'd get muddled in the order of notes, you know, and he'd give us the same lecture he gave us the week before. But he was a very humane sort of person and quite an activist about Māori issues. He thought that what was going on between Māori and European people in New Zealand was not admirable in many respects, and made that plain to us, which was interesting to have that because it wasn't a common perception in New Zealand at that time. And Ralph Woolmer was, I've always been very fond of him and admired his field work in New Guinea greatly, and I liked the way that he worked with people, with Syme, who was his key collaborator, I guess, on the birds, for example. And he had a feeling, I think, for the jungle and the wildlife of Papua New Guinea that he brought alongside his love of the people there. And, yeah, so I admired him a great deal.
Were there any sort of theoretical parts of what you were studying that interested you more than others? I mean, as you said, it was mainly, not exactly an excuse, but a way of looking further into Māori culture, but was this a time of structural functionalism? Were there any names, Edmund Beach or Marshall Sahlins or anyone who influenced you at that stage?
Well, by the time I left the University of Auckland and came to the University of Pennsylvania is when I did my PhD, you know, Ralph Piddington drilled us in Malinowski. I mean, we just knew structural function, Radcliffe Brown, but especially Malinowski. We studied that way of thinking about anthropology rigorously, and I knew a great deal about it. But I also, we had the sort of biological anthropology, physical linguistics, and social anthropology. We learned all four in our department. And so I was lucky. I worked with people like Roger Green, the Pacific archaeologist, who's still an inspiring colleague, Bruce Biggs, the linguist, and through Andy Pawley, I started to learn Chomskyan linguistics when that was just being invented, really. And so I think that was the theoretical movement that captured my imagination to begin with. And I wrote a Chomskyan grammar. Yes, of a language called Ontong Java, it's Luangyua. It's one of the Polynesian outliers. So I went there when I was 20 and did field work. And that was quite extraordinary because we had to go to Honiara. And I went there with Peter Sharples, who was a colleague of mine. He's a Māori anthropologist. And he worked with the people from Sikayana because these languages hadn't been much recorded before. And Bruce Biggs wanted to be able to include them in his reconstructions of Proto-Polynesian. So I was very young, and my father, I know, Bruce always said to me that my father and mum came to see me off at the airport, and he said that my father fixed him with a very steely glare, more or less made it plain that he was holding Bruce personally responsible for my safe return. Because Honiara was, was a fairly rambunctious frontier town, and I was just 20. But it was great. I mean, I loved it. I went there, and it was a bifurcated town racially. And you had all these people that had been in Africa and had been kicked out of Africa because of the post-colonial, as places went independent. And they were ruling the place. And there were segregated hotels and segregated bars. But Peter was Māori. And I remember going to the Hotel Honiara on our first night there to have a meal. And we got chucked out because he was brown. And that was a huge shock. Mm. And I got thrown off a beach because I was sitting there talking with one of my friends from Luangyua about seashell names, actually. We were collecting all the names of the shells. And it was a very weird experience because it was, because I was with these people from Polynesia all the time, and they were my friends. I was on the wrong side of the colour bar, if you like. And I mean, Peter and I used to call the people that walked around in these white shirts and white socks, and we used to call them white gods. Yeah. And I think I learned what racism feels like to be on the receiving end of. I mean, I didn't like it at all.
So when you came back, you then and had finished your first degree, you decided to do a PhD. Why did you go to the back of the States for that? Any reason particularly?
Well, by then, what I'd written this Chomskyan grammar, and it was published by Mutom. And I thought, well, how many people are going to read this? I mean, I've written this quasi-mathematical description of an extraordinarily rich experience that I had with these people in Honiara. And I had got to know people.
Can you spell Honiara?
It's Honiara. Yeah, it's the capital of the Solomons. And, I'd become, because I could already speak Māori to some extent, I was quite reasonably fluent in Māori language, I was able to pick up Luangyuan quite quickly, and by the end of those 3 months, because they didn't really speak English, not even pidgin, and I was dreaming in the language by the end of 3 months. So it was a very intense experience, and I didn't think that a Chomskyan grammar captured that at all. So I decided to study language and society, sociolinguistics, and I went to Philadelphia because that's where Del Hymes was and William Labov and Irving Goffman were all there, and Ward Goodenough too was there all at once. And they, at that stage, I guess, were some of the, especially Labov and Del Hymes, were the key people in sociolinguistics in the world. Mm. So that's why I went there.
Who was your supervisor?
Ward Goodenough.
Mm. As we pass famous figures, it's always nice if you can just drop in an anecdote or a characterization. What was Ward like as a supervisor or professor?
Well, I think Ward is, he's a very paternal. With his graduate students, I think he cared very much about what you were doing, and was, for me, he's always been extraordinarily supportive. He was a very generous mentor for years and years. I mean, he kept writing references for me for the next 20 years, pretty much, and stayed very closely in contact with what I was doing. He's an intensely logical thinker. We would... looking at componential analysis and all that, and because I'd trained in linguistics, that was easy for me, that way of kind of very logical analysis. I like Ward. I think he's a, you know, I think that he's one of these, he's not charismatic exactly, but he is a very fine field anthropologist who thought very deeply about what he was doing. And his take on ethno-science and trying to see things from the point of view of the local people was something that really appealed to me.
Hmm. What about the two other names you mentioned? Did you come across Goffman at all?
Yes, I studied with Goffman.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Was he like his books?
Well, Irving Goffman is a... He was... a very interesting lecturer, but disconcerting, because he was obviously an expert in face-to-face communication, and so he used to play tricks on us in class and, you know, analyse what was going on in the classroom, and you'd sort of all be sitting there as students, totally taken aback sometimes. And I had the feeling that he didn't really turn off that facility too often in his own life. That might be wrong. But Dell was a more... He was quite a philosophical anthropologist, I think, in many ways, and quite dreamy sort of person. The kind of work he was doing in language and culture, that was what I wanted. I wanted to be able to see how you could use the deep understanding of a language to understand the world of a people, the form of life, the way of being. And to do that not just at a superficial level, but right down to the fundamental understandings of how everything is in the world. And to do that with language as a avenue or series of pathways that you can explore through a lifetime. So I guess that's the freedom that I found with those people, was to get away from the rigors of a Chomsky and grammar and start thinking about semantics, about language and power, about ontology.
And were you satisfied with the thesis you did that? Because you moved away a bit from that later in your life. Was that for other reasons?
Well, no. I mean, I'm very happy with that work, because... we have to backtrack a bit. The first year that I was at the University of Auckland, I met a couple of... who were some of the most eminent Māori elders of their generation. I didn't know that at the time. I just met them at a party. I was there with a boyfriend, and there they were. And I started talking to Armedia, who was the wife of the couple. And she was a very humorous, engaging, wonderful raconteur, and we just hit it off. And so she invited me to come to their house, and I came and met up with... the couple, Eruera and Armedia, and that just became a very close relationship over the next 20 years. And so I used to go there every week, sometimes a couple of times a week, and just go and sit around, have cups of tea. Eruera started to teach me Māori. I used to speak with him in that language most of the time. He was a expert on tribal traditions and genealogy, whakapapa, and chants, and tauparapara, all these forms of esoteric knowledge. He was from the East Coast, where I'm from. And for some reason, after a while, he decided to start teaching me, so I became a kind of student of his. And so I had a parallel education. I was studying with Bruce Biggs and Ralph Bulmer and all these people, but on the other hand, I was studying with Eruera, and I was going to Marae, which are the ceremonial centres, and I was really immersing myself in that world. And it was quite a curious thing to do from my background. I mean, it was an odd thing to study Māori in those years.
At what point did you realise that this might turn into a published collaboration?
I didn't think about it like that at all, because for me they were almost like grandparents. They were, I've got a very close family of my own, but there was something about those two. I think, when we talked about a parallel universe in which I felt at home, well, they were like the people who were guardians of that place, and they became the people that took me there and enabled me to travel around freely and taught me how to think and taught me that things I thought I'd understood, I didn't understand at all, over and over again over the years. It's like just peeling away the layers of an onion, and there's still more layers always. And I loved them a lot. I was very, very close to them. And so when I was thinking about doing a PhD, I went and talked to Eruera and said, what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking about going off and doing a PhD. And he said, well, if you're really serious about wanting to understand Te Ao Māori, which is the Māori world, the Marae is the university for you now. That's the ceremonial centre. So that's the university for you now. And so I decided I would write my thesis on hui, which is ceremonial gatherings on Marae. So when I came back from having done my papers in the States, Eruera and Armedia took me to Marae for the next 2 years. We just travelled together. I had a little blue VW, and I became their driver. And we went to, 60 or 70 gatherings all over the country. And it was very intimate. We were talking, singing in the car. Eruera would explain about things. Armedia would start telling stories, because she was a great storyteller. And we'd land in these different parts of Māoridom, in these places that normally Europeans didn't go to at all. Little meeting houses tucked away in some very remote part of the country. Extraordinary places that we went to. And when we were on the Marae, it was like being in another universe. It really was. Everybody was speaking Māori. The food was different. It was very ritualized. The ancestors were present. Tapu was a power. Mana was a presence. It was just extraordinary. And I had 2 years of doing that. And Jeremy, I was married by then, and Jeremy came often, and he was the photographer. So he took these wonderful photographs while we were doing all of this. And people often explained to him things that they thought I already knew, which I didn't. And so it was great.
Have these photographs been published?
Yes, some of them. I wrote a book about that field work, which was called Hui, and it's about Māori ceremonial gatherings. And the interesting thing is that it became a kind of book for Māori people. Lots and lots of people use that as a way of knowing, how people used to do things, because it's now quite an old book.
And there were quite a lot of the photographs in that book.
Yes.
So when you finished your PhD, what was your next move?
Well, after that, I became a lecturer at the University of Auckland, and I started having kids. I had, three children in 5 years. So, but at the same time, I was writing. I learnt that I love to write, and curiously, it sort of tumbled. Each book seems to tumble out of the last one. I'm sure that happens to you as well. And what happened is, after Hui, it just so happened that our media had told all these wonderful stories about her life as we were travelling around in the car or lying in mattresses and meeting houses. And a friend of hers came round to her house, and she just published this little red book about her life up north. And our media had a look at this and flicked through it, and then she said to me afterwards, I could do a bigger book than that. And I sort of thought of all these stories of hers, and I thought, wow, that's a good idea. So we sort of sat down and started to tape and spend about 6 months, 30 or 40 large reel tapes, and I made a book of it called Armedia, The Life Story of a Māori Woman. And that was published and it won a literary award, and she was very thrilled, and the family were all tickle pink. And it's a lovely book, because it was my idea then was to step back as an anthropologist and let these people who knew more about it than me speak for themselves, and to try and share that with other people in New Zealand particularly.
Yeah. How much of it was written by you in the sense that you transferred it from what you were saying into something that would be understandable more widely?
Yeah, that's an interesting alchemy, I think, that happens from the oral transcription of the tapes into the text.
Yes.
My aim was to try and produce a text that sounded like our media talking, that did justice to her, so that you don't capture all of the little grammatical errors. But there are things that, like Māori English idioms, that I wanted to keep there because they gave the... And so her family think it sounds like her talking.
They do.
Yeah. But it doesn't, it reads, I think, quite smoothly, hopefully. Mm. Yeah. But there was some sort of, I don't know what the process was. It was just sitting there with the tapes, and then somehow there was just this...
She read it all through when you...
Yes.
Afterwards. Yeah. Made corrections.
She didn't correct too much. Mm. But, and she was very, she was ruthlessly honest. There were some things I left out because I knew that she was happy to have them published, but I knew that perhaps, you know, somebody else in the family wouldn't be, so...
About family relationships.
Yes.
Yeah. Are there any forms of knowledge that are not publishable? I mean, as in some societies, as in some Australian Aboriginal groups, there's secret knowledge that you can't... that you could tell you, but you couldn't publish?
I think with our media, it was very much a domestic book. You know, it was stories about family and about bringing up her kids on the East Coast, about what it was like to participate in the Māori Renaissance that was led by Sir Apirangi Ngata, the move to the city. So it was a book, a kinship book, really. Whereas when I started working with Eruera, because once her book was out, and he'd been sort of thinking about how could he possibly pass on his knowledge, much of which was very tapu, actually, and sacred in that way. And he'd been trying to do it by going and giving sessions back home in Whānau Apanui and by talks and things, but he was really unsatisfied with that, and so he decided that we would work together on a book. And I was quite reluctant, because I had 3 kids under 5 at that point, And also, I was quite worried about the tapu nature of the knowledge that he wanted to. But what happened? I mean, he insisted, and I couldn't say no. I mean, he was my mentor, you know, and I owed him so much. And so we started to work on it. And he approached it quite differently from our media. We used to sit and have cups of tea, and our media, my daughter, would be sitting on my lap, chuckling away, you know, and that's how we did that book. But with Eruera, we had to go away from food. He would chant a karakia, a prayer, before we started a session. And it was very serious, you know, it was very serious. And he only spoke to me the things that he knew should be released. But even so, I mean, it was a major thing to do.
When you said he only spoke to you the things that should be released, so did he off the record? Has he off the record saved the rest of it somewhere else or in some other form, or is it going to be lost?
He passed on quite a lot of it to his youngest son, Kepa. And, you know, so it went in that way down the family line. But, I mean, he had reflections about his life, about the things he'd seen happening in New Zealand. It's a really interesting book because it goes right from ancestral history right through to the things that were going on in the 80s, for example. It stops then because he died in the early 80s. But it's a very philosophical book. It's reflections on the land march, on the sort of quality of race relations in New Zealand at that time, what he thought about the various moves towards Māori rights. And he was in the heart of all of that.
And how was that book received by the white community?
Well, it was very interesting. I mean, it was published in the same year as the Springbok tour. And that was a riotous year in New Zealand. I mean, people were polarized completely.
Which year is this?
It must have been 1981. Mm. And the Springboks were touring New Zealand, and lots of people thought they shouldn't because of apartheid. Mm. And Edu Edu was published at the same time that all of that was going on. And I think that that coloured the reception. It made it actually something that people really took warmly to, because it was a statement from a Māori, a very important Māori elder, about how he saw the country and how he understood what was going on in the race relations in New Zealand. And so it won a Wattie Award, which was the top literary prize in New Zealand at that time, and things like that.
Mm. There was no hostility? You didn't get hate mail or criticism?
No, the only thing that was difficult about it is that Māori tribal knowledge is inherently, it belongs to a particular kin group, and a particular kin group or its elder will make claims that sometimes challenge the claims or the understandings of the group next up the road. And there was a little bit of that sort of people up the road sort of thinking that the things that Edu Edu had said about, you know, tribal history should have been differently inflected. But that was dealt with me. I said to the there was just one guy that came and talked to me about those sorts of issues, and I said, well, look, don't talk to me about that. You really should talk to Edu Edu. And he didn't dare. He didn't dare. And so he waited, I think, until the old man had died.
Well, those were two very productive and successful books, but at what point did you move on to your well-known study of early travels and explorations of the Pacific? Was it simultaneously or later?
Well, that actually started here in Cambridge.
Did it? When we last met?
Well, it was. I came here in 1980 to 81, and I was here for a year. I had a Nuffield Fellowship, and I came, and I was here at King's. Mm. And I had this marvellous year when I was still finishing the book with Edu Edu, and I proofed it and finished it while I was in Cambridge. And it had been a deep saturation, and it was a very Māori process, that. It was... It rocked me to the core in some ways, because he was talking at one stage of taking me to the sacred pool where he himself was initiated. I didn't want to do it because I thought, that's not me, I can't do that. And there was a point of stepping back from, I mean, his kind of tapu knowledge was not for me. You know, I was able to help him pass some of it on, but I couldn't do that. And so I was here, and I was reading. I went to, you know, I was listening to Edmund Leach, I was listening to Fortas, I was listening to Jack Goody. I went to the PhD seminar. They allowed me to participate in that.
He let me
just sit in. And I went off to History of Philosophy of Science, and I was listening to lectures in sociology. And I started wondering about how the whole relationship between Māori and European people started. And I wrote a paper while I was here about that, and I was trying to go right back to the beginning of the relationship, and I was looking at the voyages of Tasman and Cook and those early explorers in New Zealand. And I thought that the way they had been understood was monocular. It was sort of cyclopean. It was only being understood from a European point of view. And I could tell from, you know, these long conversations and this very intimate sharing of knowledge with Edu Edu that was another way of looking at it completely, which was not from the decks of the ship but from the beaches and from behind the palisades. And so I started to think about that, and it happened here.
Mm. And did you, I mean, we have a lot of Captain Cook's objects and things in our museum. Did you visit the museum?
Yes, Peter Gathercole took me in, and, you know, he... I saw the painted paddle that's in the museum, for example. I remember, and I've just looked at it again. Amy showed it to me because she's now looking after that collection, our daughter. this wonderful warrior's belt that was collected by Cook, and it's still got the red ochre in the creases, and as she points out to me, rubbed into the fabric. Mm. Yes, that was fantastic.
Mm. Of the people who you met on that occasion, you've named some of them.
Mm.
Did you get at all close to any of them, or?
Well, possibly Marilyn. Yes, well, it was interesting at that time. Marilyn was the honorary editor of Man.
Yes.
And was not playing a very prominent role in the life of the department, you might say.
Mm, yeah.
But I met her, we had kids the same age, and I thought she was absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
And loved talking to her about some of the things that I was trying to grapple with.
Mm.
And she was very helpful.
Mm.
And so we used to, you know, share times with our children, and that was lovely.
Nice. The two dames in quality should have got to know each other at that time.
Yes. But Edmund was, incredibly kind. Yes, he was. He was very generous.
Mm.
And he helped to arrange the fact that I was here at King's. And we, in fact, lived in his house that had been his house in Storey's Way.
Mm, did
Yeah.
You got on well with Edmund.
Yes.
Mm. Mm. Sometimes he didn't get on with women as well as he did with men, but...
I didn't notice that.
That's good. And you presumably got on well with Jack.
Yes, very well with Jack.
Mm.
I think Maya, I gave a paper about the things I was thinking about, the engagements between Māori and Europeans, and Maya took me out to lunch afterwards and told me I was a dangerous young woman. But I took that as a huge compliment.
So you are now beginning to be more English anthropology directed. Did you have any further dealings with the States? Did you go back for any longer periods to America?
Oh, I've always sort of kept in touch, but I haven't spent long periods in the States. I've gone back to conferences and things like that. But I think when I came to Cambridge, I realised that what I really liked was European anthropology more, perhaps, because it is more philosophical. And I've been reading. I read a lot of philosophy. And it seemed to me that anthropology really addresses philosophical questions about what it is to be, you know, a person in the world and the varieties of ways of being and trying to understand how you can you move from one to another. And for me, these were personal questions. They weren't abstract. It was me trying to make sense of my own life.
And you obviously, Jack's interest in history...
Mm.
Because you are exactly balanced between history and anthropology, really, in many ways. Did you drift towards history or take any formal courses or anything, or do you just use it as a tool in your work?
I've read quite a bit, you know, in history, and historical methodology, but I've never taken formal courses at all in history. And I started working with documents because that was the way to find out the things I wanted to understand, and partly because I've always used oral tradition as well and talked to people and collected oral histories. Keith Sinclair, the great New Zealand historian, was a friend. He was actually a student of mine. He studied Māori. There was a couple of years when I taught Māori language, and he was a student of mine in one of those years. And he was a fantastic guy. He was very supportive. But I think for me it was just getting to know archives, getting to know the documents, but always bringing to bear an anthropological imagination, I suppose.
Mm. So you don't really see any conflict between history and anthropology at all?
No, because I think they're about the same thing. They're trying to understand people, and you're trying to understand the complexity and the variety of ways of being in the world. And if you do it through talking with people directly or you do it through documents... it's just a petrified form of speech. So.
Nice image. So you wrote two books out of this Explorations Discovery, is that right?
Three.
Mm. Ah.
There's Two Worlds, which was about the very first encounters between Māori and Europeans in New Zealand, and then Between Worlds, which came to a later period, right up to the arrival of the missionaries.
Yeah.
And so they were a sort of companion set.
Yes.
And then I've written The Trial of the Cannibal Dog, which is about Cook in the Pacific, more widely.
Tell me something about that, because that's your last and very successful book. what gave you the idea for it?
Well, as I say, you know, one book tumbles out of another, and I worked on Cook's Three Voyages when I was writing Two Worlds in Between Worlds, the Endeavour Voyage in the first book and the second and third voyages in the second. And to understand Cook in New Zealand, I read back, and I sort of started at the beginning of the journals. And I have this way of dealing with the explorers when you have multiple accounts of a voyage. I've developed this method of taking A3 sheets and Xeroxing either the manuscripts or the types, you know, the printed versions of a journal, and tabulating three columns on a page, and the account of that particular day or that particular event, and the next version, and the next version, and the next version. So sometimes I'll have, you know, four or five sheets when I've got dealing with maybe 12 or 15 journals of the same set of incidents. And so I started doing that for that book, and working with in minute detail on the surviving evidence from the voyages, the charts, the logs, the images, and the things. I've got more and more interested in the artifacts. And I got curious about Cook outside of New Zealand. And I had a feeling that there was something that happened to Cook in the third voyage which had not been properly explained. And I noticed some things, you know, from this minute reading of the sources that I wanted to explore further. And there was something that happened in New Zealand right at the beginning of, at the end of the second voyage, the beginning of the third, when a boatload of Cook's men were killed in Eton in Queen Charlotte Sound. And then he came back and was persuaded by the local people that nothing had happened. And sailed away quite happily, discovered at the Cape of Good Hope that a number of his men had been killed in Eton, came back right at the beginning of the third voyage and did nothing. And a number of the men that had been involved in that, it was this consort ship that had been, the boat from the consort ship at the Adventure that had been attacked. A number of those men were back with him, and they were, you know, they were wanting him to take revenge, just dying for him to do something. And he was being the enlightened captain, and he was sort of, he had the chief protagonist of the killings in his cabin, interviewed him about it, even had his portrait painted. And there was this mock trial of a cannibal dog that had a kuri, the Polynesian dog that happens on board the consort ship. And so I'm arguing that this is a way for, it was the way in which the crew, the sailors, the ordinary, the crew, which is sending an oblique message to their commanders about how they thought the cannibals ought to be treated. And this poor kuri was taken on board. They did a mock trial, put him on trial for cannibalism, convicted him, the dog, and then killed it. And then they cooked it and ate it.
Really?
Mm. Yes, very for Englishmen. Mm. Yeah. So I got fascinated by that incident. And what I discovered was that after Cook sailed away from Queen Charlotte Sound, there was an sort of outbreak of mutinous behaviour on board, and from that moment on the floggings on board they doubled. Actually, the rate of floggings doubled, and when he arrived in Tonga, you know, the violence towards Polynesians also escalated, and they tried to kill him in Tonga, and they tried to kill him in Tahiti, and he finally was killed in Hawaii. So I'm sort of arguing something about what happened to Cook in the course of
it
the three.
It wasn't his own crew that killed him in the end, or tried to kill him in those places.
No, I think, you know, the...
This is projected. Correct?
Well, the argument that I'm making is that I think that that Cook was... And I think he and many of his men were deeply influenced by spending a decade, you know, in the Pacific. And he was forging relationships with local chiefs, changing his name with them and exchanging names, gift exchange. And I think he enjoyed being a high chief in Polynesia. But I think that trying to be a high chief in Polynesia and an enlightened Royal Naval Captain it was just too difficult. It was just something that was too paradoxical to be able to manage in the end. And I think it started to fly apart after, you know, the cannibalism was just too much of a provocation to his own men. And there are sort of doggerel poems about him. You know, they call him Tute, which is his Tahitian name, and talk about the rages that he was throwing on the deck and so on. And I think his men felt that he'd let them down because he'd done nothing to the people that had eaten their mates, their shipmates. And the relationship between him and his men was destabilized, and so he was turning to the, you know, to the floggings, and then he started to let things happen on shore when they were on the, in the islands, that he hadn't allowed before. And so people were being hooked with boat hooks and gouged, and floggings of 70 lashes for old Tongan men. And he was trying to take high chiefs hostage. And his pattern of behaviour just shifted. But I think in the wooden world of the ship, the relationship between the commander and the men is a very delicate balance in there. And if you, and he'd been trusted and admired by his men for the first two voyages, absolutely. And something went wrong in the dynamic of the third.
This is all in the book.
It's all in the book.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I look forward to that very much indeed. So we're just drawing towards a conclusion, but there are just one or two more questions, if I may. One is obviously what you're doing now, and what is tumbling out of that book?
Yes. I'm working on another project which is about voyaging. I think I've spent a lot of time now on the islands, and quite a bit of time, curiously enough, with I've got very interested, for example, in the experimental voyaging that's happening now in the Pacific with replica canoes, but also there's the replica endeavour, you know, going around the Pacific, and there's something going on with new encounters with the ocean, which is very fascinating, that the two things are not coinciding. You know, there's the endeavour going around, the replica canoes, but they're not meeting as they did originally at all, not yet anyway. And in any case, I'm working on a major project on the first 200 years of European voyaging in Polynesia. And I think the first book I'm going to write out of that is going to be about the European discovery of Tahiti. Because there's this small, glorious Polynesian island that in a decade becomes a, it just has all these European ships coming through. It's the crossroads of Europe. You know, you've got Wallace from Britain, and then you get Bougainville from France, Cook, and then there's three Spanish voyages from Lima, and then you've sort of got Bligh, the Bounty, Providence, and all of, and people are going off to Cook takes to Pyre, right around the Pacific up to Batavia, where he dies. Ahutoru was taken by Bougainville to Paris. Eight Tahitians go to Lima. And I just want to understand all of that, because I think there's a wonderful set of stories in there that need to be understood.
Well, that's a lifetime's work. More books will hopefully tumble out very fast. Are there any things that you'd like to me to have asked you, or any things you'd like to say about your work or your family or anything?
I think the thing that's been fortunate for me, I think I have loved being an anthropologist in my own country. Equally, I've loved being able to come away from it from time to time to places like Cambridge to sit and think away from the dynamics and the struggles, if you like, that go on. But there's been, it's a very interesting thing when I write very much for a New Zealand audience. I know what Māori people, that many Māori people and now Pacific people will read the things that I write. And I'm acutely aware of that audience. And there have been challenges, you know. There have been times when people have been saying no white people should be writing about Māori life. You know, only Māori people could understand the intricacies and depths of Māori knowledge. And those have been very violent debates in New Zealand, very violent. And I think on the whole it's been a very productive and creative context in which to think as an anthropologist, because you can't take anything for granted. You can't adopt a sense of authority, you know, a tone of authority in any easy way at all. And I've always taught, many of my students have been Māori too, and so I think there's a kind of grounding and a humility that comes in that context where you realise that actually your authority is always second hand. and the things that you've learned, you've been taught. I don't think of the people that have taught me as informants. I think of them as my teachers. And in many ways, they've shaped the way I think as an anthropologist. I don't think only in a European way about anthropology. I think it's been very much influenced by my Polynesian experience. And so I think about reciprocity, utu. I think about mana and respecting the mana of the people that I write about. I think about tapu as a power, not just an interesting concept for anthropologists to play with, but as a power in the world.
And
yes, I do. I do. I've experienced it. Yeah.
That's interesting. Can you give an example?
Well, you can't move around with someone like Irueta for 20 years and not experience tapu. And there have been times when I've been terrified by it. There have been things that have happened to me that shouldn't happen in the world. And so I think that's one of the difficult things about entering into another way of being in an increasingly deep way over 20 years, is that it can just start challenging some of the totally unnoticed presuppositions that you have about how the world works. And for some people, madness lies that way. It's happened to people in New Zealand. People that have got very involved with Māori things that have lost their balance. And I guess that I decided that I am who I am. I'm a Pākehā person that knows and loves about Māori things. But I'm not a Māori. And so that's been a very interesting, painful sometimes, experience to have to work that out.
Humble thoughts on perhaps which to end. So thank you very much indeed, Anne. That was lovely.
Thanks, Alan.